Hey, I'm Jeff Cohen. Everything you hear on WNPR, from local news and talk shows to the national programs you love, is made possible because of listener support. You make it happen. You give the radio its signal, the computer its stream, the smartphone its podcast. You make it so we can reach you wherever you are. We love that you listen, but we also need your dollars. Go to WNPR.org and click on Donate in the upper right-hand corner. Thanks for helping out.
So I actually have a few of Donald Trump's tax returns here with me. Rachel Maddow dropped them out in the hall. I picked them up. He deducts Tic Tacs as a medical expense. That's not right. Yeah, you can't do that. No, actually, we don't. We don't have any of Donald Trump's tax returns, apart from the one that's been much discussed. And the reason for that is because he refuses to give them up. And you might think, well, that was an issue from the campaign. On the other hand, many people think it's an issue that still has quite a bit of legitimacy and may even have more pertinence as time goes on. For that reason, thousands of people sprinkled around or scattered around a whole bunch of different American cities had protest rallies this weekend. And we are going to talk about those protest rallies here at the beginning of the show. Let me tell you, at the end of the show, we're going to be joined by Seth Stevenson for a related but different topic. Seth has been going to a lot of Sean Spicer's press briefings. I'm sort of convinced that people are more familiar at this point with Melissa McCarthy as Sean Spicer than they are with Sean Spicer. But anyway, he has an assessment of Sean Spicer's performance as a briefer of the press, and I want to talk to him about that. I have my own thoughts about this, too. I'll just quickly say, reading Seth's excellent piece, I was reminded, and I went back today and watched some of Mike McCurry's press briefings for Bill Clinton. He was the guy handling the briefings during the thick of the Lewinsky case. And I think it is fair to say, well, I don't know whether it's fair to say or not, but I personally don't think Bill Clinton would have made it through this process without Mike McCurry. He was that good. I'm not sure that Bill Clinton as a political matter could have survived without the tremendous work that McCurry did in that role. He's the best that I've ever seen in my lifetime, and I'm 117 years old. All right, so let's get started, though, with these protests around the country. It was tax day. You could say it was tax chicken day. Joining us right now are two of the architects of this. They are different kinds of architects. Frank Lesser is joining us, Emmy-winning comedy writer for The Colbert Report and the author of Sad Monsters, growling on the outside, crying on the inside. And then Casey Lachelet, who's a motion graphics artist and designer. He is considered to be the birther of the tax chicken, which makes me think that Casey actually would be questioning the citizenship of the tax chicken as opposed to actually having created the tax chicken. I believe actually he is. Although Casey, you may have done both, right? You may have created the tax chicken and then decided it was born in some other country.
Sure. As a matter of fact, yeah, that's pretty true.
Right. Exactly. Born in China. But we'll come to that. So Frank Lesser, I'm going to start with you. I guess my first question is, well, actually, let's set the scene a little bit. So, I mean, this was a hard thing to keep track of and quantify because these rallies and protests kept kind of springing up. And so do you have any idea here in the last analysis how many people or how many places there were tax day rallies that concerned themselves with the tax returns of President Donald Trump?
I believe the final tally is well over 100,000 people total in almost maybe more than 200 cities. I think it's up to about 150,000. New York alone had anywhere from 30,000 to 45,000. You'd think it would be easier to count tons of people. So maybe counting is hard, and maybe we should cut Donald Trump some slack on his taxes. He might just be having trouble figuring out how many dollars he owes to China or Russia or anything else, as I've learned now from the experience with the tax march. But there were 25,000 people in D.C. There were hundreds of people in West Palm Beach who actually blocked Trump's car. They had to turn around to get to Mar-a-Lago. It's been sort of crazy, the number of people who, contrary to Trump's claims, do care about his tax returns.
The I have so many things to say about this. First of all, I just want to say here on this show, we also do use what's called adjusted Sean Spicer math, ASS. So you can, under that, you are allowed to add a zero to any crowd number.
oh, yeah. No, I think it was 1.5 million.
There you go. That's a little bit more the kind of thing that I'm looking for. So, and I believe the president of the United States indicated that these were paid protesters.
Yes, in one of his two tweets about it, I was beforehand, I was like, there's like a 30% chance that he'll actually tweet. And he actually tweeted twice. So if you do the math, I think you could figure out the exact number of people who have to show up in the exact number of cities to trigger the commander-in-chief, which is a terrifying thing. You would think there'd be other things he'd have to do. I guess actually his main responsibility is watching kids roll Easter eggs on the White House lawn. So maybe he's got, I think other people are handling the heavy lifting with him.
Right. There is no such math as that, by the way. But although I would say one of the tweets was, I did what was almost an impossible thing to do for a Republican, easily won the Electoral College. Now tax returns are brought up again, ? And then in another tweet, should look into who paid for the small organized rallies yesterday, adding the election is over. So it's kind of in the first tweet, he is actually very concerned in a not terribly accurate way with his performance in the election. In the second tweet, he would like everyone to discard all notions of the election. So you managed Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, no, with that, I always, the people always say that, the criminal returns to the scene of the crime, which makes me wonder why Trump is always still talking about the election that he supposedly won in such a big league manner. So, not that I'm accusing him of anything shady, but I think there are a lot of things that he's probably hiding. But as far as who paid for the protesters, it was the protesters ourselves. We were funding whatever we could, trying to raise money for the giant chickens based on Casey's great design. And it's an easy thing to try to push off that there are paid protesters, but I think that's a little bit more accurate on his side. And what Republicans tend to do is accuse their opponents of the things they're actually doing. Hillary's, Crooked Hillary, Lion Ted.
Right, let's hear, I think people are familiar with Donald Trump's position on his tax returns, but for people who maybe just woke up, well, actually, we had somebody on last week who, this wonderful, wonderful man who had a terrible heart incident as a result, partly, he thinks, of stress from the election and was put into a coma and an induced coma and then woke up having forgotten the results of the election and had to go through all that stress all over again. So I no longer say for people just waking up from a deep sleep or anything, because actually, apparently, that does happen to people. So instead, let's just hear Donald Trump talking about the issue of his tax returns.
Well, I'm not really saying the tax returns because, as you know, they're under audit.
Since the 70s, has had a required audit from the IRS.
Oh, gee, I've never heard that.
But ask
I've never heard that.
Sir,
the only one that cares about my tax returns are the reporters. Okay,
you don't think the American public is concerned about
it? No, I don't think so. I won.
Do you believe that?
When I became president. No, I don't think they care at all. I don't think they care at all. I think you care. I think you care.
So, Frank Lesser, we now know more people than just the press, the enemies of the people, care about the tax returns, right? I mean, we don't have a hard number, but we know it's maybe six figures or more.
Definitely. And I think just the number of people who were tweeting and retweeting about this and getting angry about it and sort of upset. And by the way, the applause in that clip, I would imagine, are from Trump's paid supporters or his fluffers, basically, the Trump fluffers who he brings to all of his press appearances or, that sort of infamous thing in front of the CIA memorial wall the day after his inauguration, where everybody who worked at the CIA was like, who are all the people clapping here? Well, those are Trump's paid supporters.
Just to be strictly lexicographically accurate, I would say that people applaud after the fluffer does his job. I don't think you're actually a fluffer just because you applaud. But I could be wrong about that. So, Casey, we got to get you into this. Although, before we do that, let's play one more clip. This is a person who was very concerned about Donald Trump's taxes and thought that the argument that they were under audit was a specious one. I'll play the clip, and then we can all guess who it is who's talking.
I'm an accountant. I can tell you there is no audit that precludes you from showing your tax return. Donald Trump, show us your tax returns!
Anybody able to place that voice?
Someone who was surely paid by Frank. Frank, by the way, I haven't gotten my check yet. So
let me see. I'm going to Google various elected officials to see which are.
It's Nikki. It was Nikki Haley who is currently his UN ambassador, but that was sort of earlier in time when she was more of a Rubio supporter. So we have to talk about this chicken. Now there's a I don't know. We have to explain about the chicken for people who maybe didn't see the chicken this weekend. So Casey, in your own words, explain about this chicken.
Well, I was originally contacted by a real estate company in China to make this what was a rooster for the Year of the Rooster. They made a giant statue of it, and then subsequently, as China does, reproduces it in mass quantities in any and every way possible. So these inflatables came out of that. And Frank, I heard a little bit about kind of how this came about. Like, you guys were in a meeting and kind of circling around the idea of a chicken, and then this just like fell into your lap, which is like amazing. like kind of the best way for someone like me to kind of express my quote unquote art. You know, and it just kind of took a life of its own, and it's pretty amazing what happened.
I will say, Casey, you know, Richard Nixon, upon visiting China and going to the Great Wall, said, "It is indeed a great wall." And I want to say to you, it is indeed a great chicken.
One day I would love to go see it in person, yeah, but the inflatables are a good stopgap for sure.
And so we should say that Frank and I are at liberty to draw our own conclusions about what the chicken actually resembles or who the chicken actually resembles. It is your official position that the chicken simply exists on its own, resembling nothing or no one other than a chicken.
Right. And that's it's pretty coincidental, isn't it?
It's the Year of the Rooster, the proud rooster.
Yeah.
You know, by the way, Frank sat there very quietly, not making a joke about roosters reproducing and fluffers. You know, that was all on the table.
Well, that's why when we were having we were also modifying it a little bit to turn him more into a round hen who's sitting on his nest egg. And I do want to just give credit to Dan L. Morton, was the organizer in San Francisco, who Googled Trump's a big chicken and looked it up, and then she saw Casey's design and was like, "This is amazing," and convinced at least 15 or 20 of the marches to like, and was communicating with the salesperson in China at like weird hours of the day to make sure that all the balloons would get here on time. But it was an amazing thing that sort of was the second viral thing to sort of spread about this whole march. But it's really an amazing chicken, an amazing rooster, Casey.
Thank you. She is fantastic, by the way. She reached out to me a while ago, basically saying like, how can I get this inflatable? And I was like, I have absolutely no idea. I like talked to the people that contacted me for like who I made it originally, and they're like, we didn't do that. And I was like, okay, well, you're no help. So I was like, good luck. I put her in touch with someone else that, you know, seemed like he was getting some headway, and she made it happen. Like, I was like dumbfounded by like the initiative and like how crazy resourceful she was.
It's going to take that. It's going to take that kind of resourcefulness to change America. You're going to have throw yourself into a project like this. Now, it's a 13-foot tall inflatable chicken. How many of these chickens currently exist?
I don't have the specific number. I know that the one in San Francisco, I think, was 33 feet tall, but as 60.
60-foot chickens? Oh, wow.
I don't think any of the marches ordered the 60-foot chickens, and I think at least one place that ordered another 30-footer had some trouble with some big wins, but they were primarily, I think, 14 feet, 10 feet. We had a 6-foot one in New York. San Francisco had multiple ones, including the 30 or 33-foot one in front of the state capital. And it definitely was great seeing it in front of the Capitol building in D.C. The New York one we had right catty corner to Trump Tower. I'm not sure how many there are, but actually one of the Chicago organizers, Taran Singh Brar, is, I think, trying to organize a chicken march in a few months to bring all of the chickens in the United States down to D.C. and have sort of a parade. I mean, it's basically a chicken hawk parade. I was suggesting that he also get some inflatable tanks, because, of course, Trump wanted tanks at his actual inauguration, and try to have this whole chicken parade go by the main Capitol. So Google, check out Tarin. I'm sure he'll keep pushing it. Look up Chicken March. That might happen.
Well, I have many more questions about this. We have to take a break. I do want to just say, just to be upfront about it, I'm in talks with the Niederlander group about an all-chicken Les Mis, where like the whole cast would be these inflatable chickens. All right, so let's take a break, and we'll come back after this.
Hide and stall. And an audit's no excuse at all. Show us your taxes. Yeah, show your taxes.
All right, we're back. We're talking a little bit about Saturday's tax day chicken protests. I do want to say just quickly, just as a matter of historical record, because this is public radio and we do care about history, the chicken trope has been used in previous times. There was a Chicken George who was agitating on behalf of Bill Clinton in 1992 over the reluctance of George H.W. Bush to debate Bill Clinton. And then there was a chicken in 1997 that's spent the entire election campaign in Britain looking for Tony Blair, although Tony Blair was relatively easy to find in those days. But I guess, once again, the feeling was that Tony Blair wasn't willing to debate or confront his adversaries. So, but we've come, you know, those weren't inflatable chickens. We've come into a new era, really. There's the dawning of a new day. And so we're talking a little bit about that today with Casey Latchley, motion graphics artist and designer and creator of The Tax Chicken, and Frank Lesser, Emmy-winning comedy writer for The Colbert Report and the author of Sad Monsters, Growling on the Outside, Crying on the Inside. So, Casey Latchley, not to say that you could become incredibly wealthy doing this, but, like, I kind of want one of these now, one of these inflatable chickens. I don't want a 13-foot-tall one. I probably want about a 6-foot. I mean, is there any plan to have the average consumer be able to, you know, order them from Amazon or something?
Unfortunately, that's not my domain. I mean, really, where I signed away essentially the life of the design of this to, I was a work for hire for it. There is someone that acquired his, he went through his due diligence to kind of like acquire the right to sell them in the States. And it's his website's cockytrump.com. And there's an actual like little ceramic desk toy if you wanted to get that. It's not currently available right now, I would imagine, because he had a huge influx of them recently. But I have another thing, if anyone probably tried to look me up or anything, another little desk toy that I'm working on. I've been talking with lawyers to try and get that, you know, try and not get sued for this.
That's a good thing just to say into the mirror when you get up in the morning.
As much as possible.
Yeah, when you get up in the morning, go into the bathroom mirror and just say, let's try not to get sued today.
You are beautiful. You won't get sued today. Great. The day's off.
But Donald Trump might, but the president might tweet about you.
Yeah, right. That's fine. You know, whatever.
So what's the new desk toy?
So it's called Dictator. It's kind of it's kind of a play on a on
don't explain
potato.
It. Yeah, don't explain it too carefully if it is what I think
exactly.
It is.
I'm being very choice with my words here. Yeah, if anyone Googles Dictator, with an E instead of it's DICKTATER. You might stumble across it, and then eventually it'll probably be a Kickstarter to make them a real life thing.
So it's sort of it's your first NSFW desk toy, you know, like a desk toy you really can't have at work. So
I would say it's not work.
To clarify, that's a Mr. Potato Head, but it looks like Trump. I think I saw a picture of it before. It was
not
really
not at liberty to make that conclusion, but yes, right. That might be it.
Sorry. It's a potato. It's a potato.
Yeah, it's a potato. It's just got shoes on.
Yeah, well, anyway, I'm concerned, Casey. I feel like, you know, this other guy, he's like Hesh in The Sopranos. Didn't he get, like, all the rights to all the music by black rock and roll artists in the early days, you know?
You know, I would much rather I would much rather have a different president than make a lot of money on this, so I'm fine.
All right, so, you know, Frank, as these first of all, which you were at the New York demonstration, correct?
Yes, yeah, and I had helped sort of national and the D.C. march early on and then decided to focus a little more on the New York one. I was talking to Taryn in Chicago and Danelle and Ann Pruitt in San Francisco, Delia Brown in L.A. and a couple other places just to try to and National was trying to coordinate, but it's very difficult to get all of this stuff going. It's basically like running a presidential campaign across the country, but there's no presidential candidate, there's no campaign manager, and every local city or state is allowed to do whatever they want. So it's a little complicated and somehow actually turned out really well.
And, I mean, as you talked to people and maybe even took the measure of the protest that you were at, is it all about the tax returns? Is it about a more generalized sense of dissatisfaction?
For me, the tax returns just symbolize his secrecy. And just the day before the march, he announced that the White House would not release their visitor log. So we don't know who he's meeting with. The tax returns are sort of all about, well, who does he owe money to? Who's he actually working for? Or are all of his economic plans really just to benefit himself and his own family? And I don't think that's necessarily what was getting people as upset, because I think it's pretty clear that everything he does is only to benefit himself and his own family, and I think he only likes his family because they share half their genes with him. But I think there were a lot of things. Just in general, it was an anti-corruption protest. That's how I was looking at it, but the nice thing was that it was all the marches were autonomous, and some people wanted to join because they were protesting economic inequality, and that was a component of it. So there were a lot of different things that people were upset about, or they just wanted to come to see the big giant chicken and take a selfie in front of it, which was perfectly valid.
Yeah, and I do think also the big giant chicken, Frank, was a good idea in the sense that one of the things that I think we do know about President Trump is that, you know, given the choice of directing a keenly worked out, finely nuanced, deeply grained argument against him and confronting him with something that is sort of a little bit more garish and stark, he responds much more vividly and strongly to the latter, right? It's like, you know, is one of the reasons that Saturday Night Live has been able to troll him so effectively all this time is that, you know, a 2,000-word piece in the New Republic is probably not going to reach him at all. Something like a chicken, I would assume, Frank, would be the kind of thing that would get his attention anyway.
Oh, definitely, because it's the exact same thing he would have called his opponents if they were in the same situation. So Chicken Donald is what I think his childish, immature nickname would have been for Crooked Hillary, Lion Ted, Little Rubio, or Little Marco, I guess. So now we've got Chicken Donald.
Go ahead. Finish your thought, Frank.
And I think one thing that's good about these protests, and this was not necessarily intentional, but is to keep things a little bit light, because it's otherwise a very depressing, disturbing subject. And as Casey was saying, it's not a thing that we want to be doing. Like, oh, great, we had the successful protest. You know what would have been better if we didn't have to protest because we didn't have a corrupt president?
And so, Casey, you went to San Francisco, right? Describe what you saw there.
There was a ton of people. At the time, there wasn't, I don't think the plan was to have an inflatable in Seattle, because that's where I live. And so I was like, I just want to go see this. And that was so accommodating, and I was like, I just want to meet you. So I went down there, and there's quite a lot of people. Nancy Pelosi talked. It was great. It was incredibly peaceful, and I think it was just because, like, he needs to release his taxes, and everyone else is like, yeah. It's like there's no fight. Like, everyone's like, yeah, of course, duh. So it was very peaceful, and energetic, I guess. It was infectious, you know, the amount of, like, the energy that was going around, and, you know, seeing, like, little kids yelling for this. It's like, you may not understand, but at least having the ability to protest about this and, like, bringing everyone together for this one thing was really inspiring.
I would say also, Casey, are you a regular visitor to San Francisco?
No, this is actually my first time.
All right. Well, what I would tell you is it really, you know, isn't that different most of the time, and that it's really one place where you could have a 30 or 60 foot inflatable chicken and not really necessarily have that be most memorable.
I was absolutely expecting that, for sure.
Yeah. No, they – so, you know, Frank, I just – as we're running out of time here, but as we conclude, I do want to say this has to be one of the more unusual protests in the history of protest. I mean, usually protests are about, like, ending a war or something, you know? it's amazing you got that many people out about paperwork.
Yeah. Oh, well, one of the funniest things, at the end, we're walking, and I was leading the banner because I spoke at the New York March, and, you know, there were a lot of people who were upset with Kellyanne Conway's comments, but I had written a tweet that went viral, and a lot of other people did, too. Jen Taub wrote stuff. Wes Shockley and Liz Tersey in New York had also started up a Facebook page independently, but walked by this one guy who was talking to the police, and he's looking at this giant, you know, mass of people stretching down about 12 blocks or further, and he turns to the police, and he's like, wait, this is all these people just want to see his tax returns? And he was sort of shocked, and I kind of shouted out, because we care! But that is really the case. Like, people were really upset, and not everybody was upset enough to go and actually march, but I think people really do care about this. When you look at it, up to 74% of Americans think he should release his tax returns. A majority of Republicans think he should release his tax returns. It's not a crazy ask. It's what every president has done for the last 40 years. So the fact that he won't do it and would rather have 100,000 people marching against him across America makes you really think that what's in there is more damaging than that march.
Hashtag deductions matter. All right. Well, listen, thanks so much, Frank Lesser, Emmy-winning comedy writer for The Colbert Report, author of Sad Monsters Growing on the Outside, Crying on the Inside, one of the organizers of the somewhat spontaneous tax marches on Saturday. Also, Casey Lachelet, motion graphics artist and designer and the creator of the tax chicken, which may or may not resemble the President of the United States. Okay, some very nice people are about to come on and ask you in a very brief little interlude to support this kind of programming. If this is the kind of insanity, like, you know, inflatable chickens, that kind of thing, the kind of insanity you want to support, then do it right now, because we get a little bit more credit if you make a pledge during our time slot.
Show us your tax returns, because we care.
Wrong. They don't. No one cares.
Show us your tax returns, because we care.
No, nobody cares. That's fake news.
Show us your tax returns, because we care.
Believe me, nobody cares.
Show us your tax returns, because we care.
I'm going over my tax form. By checking this box, you agree to file as a loser and a hater. Can they make me do that? Today's show was produced by Betsy Kaplan and me, Kyone Wolf, with help from Josh Nalea. Our intern is Ali Onassis O'Shaughnessy Obladi Oblada Oshinsky. It's her last day today. Ali, thank you for all of your very hard work. We are definitely going to miss you. The part of Bill Curry was played by Harry Styles. On tomorrow's show, how animated cartoons grew up. And now, back to Colin.
You know, let me just add my voice to that chorus. Ali Oshinsky's been a really, really good intern. A possible contender for the Lydia Brown Trophy, the coveted Lydia Brown Trophy for greatness in interning. But she's been really terrific and has, you know, produced her own shows on her own episodes of several different shows here. So, which a lot of interns, you know, some interns do that, some interns don't. She did. So, we're going to talk about Sean Spicer right now. I would contend... Seth Stevenson, our guest, may dispute me on this, but I would contend that the version of Sean Spicer that more Americans know is this one.
Everybody shut up so I can apologize. Yes, you all got your wish this week, didn't you, huh? Spicy finally made a mistake. As we all know, President Trump recently bombed Syria while eating the most beautiful piece of chocolate cake America has ever laid eyes on. That's a fact, okay? People love that look on that cake. Now, in defending the president's decision, I said that unlike Syrian leader, the leader of, son of, what is his stupid name? I got Bazooka Felicia Ahmad Rashad. At least Hitler never used chemical weapons. And everybody freaked, okay? They were all like, boo-hoo! Boo-hoo, what about the Holocaust centers? And yeah, I know they're not really called Holocaust centers. Duh. I know that. I'm aware. I clearly meant to say concentration clubs. Okay. Let it drop.
All right. So that, of course, is Melissa McCarthy on this past weekend's Saturday Night Live. Seth Stevenson is with us, frequent contributor to Slate and the author of Grounded, A Down-to-Earth Journey Around the World. He's here to share his observations on White House Press Secretary Sean Spicer and the concept of press secretaries in general. Seth has been to a lot of Sean Spicer briefings. So, Seth, one thing that you say, I mean, I just said that the Melissa McCarthy version is a more familiar one, but one of the things that you begin your article by saying is that a lot of Americans are starting to consider the Spicer briefings as appointment television. Make the case for that.
Well, you can look at the TV ratings, something like 4.3 million people tuning in to these briefings during the day and you know, more talked about. I think than any, you know, presidential press briefing, White House press briefing, press secretary activity that we can remember. I mean, just the very fact that you're playing that Melissa McCarthy clip on Saturday Night Live means it's punctured the cultural consciousness more than, say, an Ari Fleischer briefing or certainly, you know, in the Obama administration, a Josh Earnest or a Jay Carney briefing ever did. And by the way, you know, I think that Melissa McCarthy clip, that's actually not an unfair portrayal of what these briefings are like in terms of her tone. Her aggro tone is not that far off, to be honest, if you listen to him every day.
Right. So I would say, and we can maybe get into this a little bit later, but some of this may be generational in focus, but I would say the most memorable press secretary prior to Sean Spicer in my memory is probably Mike McCurry, who in fact had a similarly impossible job getting Bill Clinton through the Lewinsky scandal, but he did it. And he did it in a way that's pretty much the polar opposite of Sean Spicer's approach. But let's talk a little bit more about Sean Spicer's approach. I think one of the questions, the fundamental existential questions about Sean Spicer is he this is a very unflattering question as I'm thinking about it now, but is he horribly unsuited for his job and or at least has such certain personal liabilities that are just undeniable and are there and would be there under any circumstances? Or is he being sent out on a press secretary's equivalent of a kamikaze mission on many, many days, having to defend the indefensible or claim that something which is blatantly false is true?
I think it's more the latter. You know, this is a guy, despite some of the caricatures, he is a little, his felicity with the English language is not what you might expect from someone who speaks professionally for a living. He trips over words, he gets them wrong, and, you know, you might expect a little more from him on that front. But I think the main problem, this is a guy who used to work for the RNC, the Republican National Committee, and, you know, was long known in Washington, D.C. as a solid press secretary. And people who knew him then and watch him now say, what happened to him? You know, who is this new guy? Because he's being sent out to defend the indefensible. He's being sent out to defend demonstrable lies, which no press secretary can really do. So I think it's that, the pressure of that. And I think, you know, one person who used to work with him at the RNC said to me that he felt that Sean Spicer's under more pressure to be combative. And that tone, that aggressive tone that he took, you know, you saw it on the very first day when he came out the day after the inauguration and he summoned the White House press pool to the White House and he didn't take any questions from them. He just wanted to make a statement to them. That statement was, you're terrible. You're getting everything wrong. The new sheriff is in town. Now get out of here. And that, you know, that was an effort to set the tone. And you could see him, you know, he was very purposefully taking an angry stance towards him. And he would kind of simmer down at times and get a little calmer and then seem to almost remember, oh, wait, I'm supposed to be real tough on them. Let me get tough again. So I think he's getting some directives from people on high. And I think he's being sent out to defend things that are very hard to defend. And that's the bigger problem for him.
Yeah, as your piece is fascinating, by the way, and it really reminded me of what a complicated job this is and how it's not necessarily a consistent job. In other words, every press secretary has a specific set of challenges to overcome, and maybe the mission is even a little bit different. And certainly, you know, we can go back to Ron Ziegler and Dick Nixon, although Dick Nixon didn't really run initially as an opponent of the press or as a guy who, you know, was going to make the press his enemy both during his campaign and in the early days of his presidency. But I mean, in a way, Spicer in doing that in his first briefing was, yeah, it's sort of like those, that whole idea that, you know, your first day in prison, you walk out in the yard and punch the biggest guy in the face. His first day on the job, he punches the entire press in the face. But there's a reason for that, right? Not just that he's a dummy, but because that's a little bit of the fundamental argument of the Trump administration. We will not be governed by the press.
Yeah, that's sort of their policy. I mean, you saw Trump during the campaign use the press as props, right? He put the press in these pens, in these essentially cages at his rallies, and say, these are the most disgusting people I've ever seen. He'd urge all of his supporters at the rallies to turn around and boo us. And, you know, that was props. That was using the media as props. That was a way, you know, his supporters love nothing more than for him to tell them how terrible the press is. And so they're still looking for ways to do that, even now that they're in power. And one way to do that is to look like they're being really tough on the White House press pool. The thing is, when you come out and try to cow the White House press pool, they are not going to be cowed. And if anything, I think that's riled them up. And I think you're getting much more aggressive questions in response to that.
Right. So, you know, in general, if a lot of people know the name of your press secretary, something's gone wrong. I mean, you know, Ari Fleischer became kind of famous at a time when the Bush presidency was facing big challenges. McCurry, I've mentioned before, you know, but really most people would be hard pressed to summon names like Josh Earnest or Joe Lockhart. Or, I mean, these are not famous people. And in a way, a lot of the job is to be this kind of blank canvas onto which the presidency, the administration collectively can paint whatever message it has on a given day. You know, if your personality is a thing people know about, that is a suggestion that something's gone a bit off the rails.
Right. I mean, you're not supposed to make news at a White House press briefing. So I spoke to someone who'd worked in a previous administration, worked very intimately involved in the briefing process. And the thing they said to me was, you know, if you as a White House have something you want to announce, if there's news you want to make, the press briefing is the last place you're going to do it. You're going to have to put the president front, you know, up front to talk about it if it's something you're proud of. Or you're going to put the cabinet secretary who's in charge of this to talk about it. You're not going to have your press secretary do it. So what a press secretary's role is, for the most part, is to play defense. They're basically answering the queries of the press pool and trying not to make news. And for the most part, they do a good job of it. There aren't a lot of really memorable moments from press briefings over the years. You know, if you go sort of through modern history and these things, you had Gerald Terholst, who is the press secretary for Gerald Ford, who resigned when Ford pardoned Nixon. He resigned out of principle. That is the only press secretary to resign out of principle that we know about, at least, in the history of press secretaries. So, you know, for people who are thinking that Sean Spicer is just going to fall down on his knees and say, you're right, I'm defending lies, I can't do it anymore, that is very unlikely. Ari Fleischer was asked on his last day, the George W. Bush press secretary, Ari Fleischer, who, you know, was the press secretary in the depths of the Iraq War. He was asked, at any moment, did you feel like, you know, you wanted to resign? Is there anything that caused you that gave you pause about resigning? He said, absolutely not. Not for one second. You know, Mike McCurry was sort of the first televised press secretary. You mentioned the Mike McCurry and the Monica Lewinsky stuff. That's when they started turning on the cameras in the briefing room and making it a soap opera. And he made it through. And you know, even, you know, it's hard. We're hard pressed to remember. We remember the moments of Clinton talking about that scandal. We don't remember so much individual moments of Mike McCurry, the depths of the Iraq War, Ari Fleischer. You know, we don't. There's not a lot of news gets made at these things.
Right. So the best press secretaries ever are the ones on television, Allison Janney in West Wing. Cal Penn is doing an excellent job on Designated Survivor right now. But Mike McCurry, I think, was the closest thing to that, what we often see on television, which is this kind of dry urbanity, but also some collegial wit, you know, the sense that the press and the press secretary are all in on a joke, which they have a common appreciation of. Here is a little bit of McCurry during that time.
To what extent is there debate, dispute among the senior staff about how to handle this? And has there been shouting matches, as has been reported?
No, I mean, I checked around with, I haven't necessarily been in each and every meeting, but I haven't found anyone who says there were any shouting incidents. And I've actually been myself talking pretty extensively to the legal counsel and some of the president's private attorneys. I've found them to be not only amicable, but very anxious to support the objectives that some of us are stressing. And more importantly, the legal rights that the institution of the presidency has in our system. And I think it's perfectly proper that we balance out those interests. I think the attitude here is the president wants to, you know, speak to the American people on these questions, and he wants to get it done, but we want to get it done right.
You have to almost watch a McCurry press briefing, too. There is, I mean, this is a cliche, but there kind of is a twinkle in his eye a lot of the time, some smiles. There's kind of a sense that, I got this. And Spicer kind of is doing the opposite thing. Now, Seth, one thing that McCurry did was he would come out, and he was kind of superbly in control. He was like this very relaxed MC at a White House correspondence dinner or something, whereas Spicer's in a terrible position, not only because he has to defend all this crazy stuff, but I didn't realize this till I read your article. People are like handing him notes in Sharpie during the press briefing. Tell us about this.
Yeah, that's right. So you'll see if you watch these every day, as I have, not infrequently, he'll be in the middle of saying something and an aide will come over and hand him a little note written in Sharpie. And so there's a lot of theorizing about who is writing these notes in Sharpie. We know that Donald Trump has been known to write in Sharpie. Some people think it might be Donald Trump watching on TV from the Oval Office or from somewhere in the White House and phoning down a note or sending a note via aide to Sean Spicer in the middle of the briefing, telling him to say something. And Sean Spicer will get these notes, look at them for a second, and then read from them or say, you know, some approximation of them. Now, the person I talked to who worked in a previous administration who was part of the briefing process said, there is no way that we would ever do that from the podium. There's no way we would be handed a note during a briefing and just wing it like that, because that means you haven't gone over the language carefully. You haven't talked to the principals involved about where the lines are, what we can say, what we can't say, how we're going to answer the inevitable questions, opening this up, you know, to broader inquiry. You're winging it, and that you never, ever want to be doing that. And so that was shocking to this person who had worked in the briefing process before, that Spicer would allow that to happen. He's completely out of control in that situation.
I just want to say also, we're almost out of time here. It's a great article by Seth Stevenson. And, you know, you don't have to be a genius necessarily to do this job. Dana Perino, for example, admitted later on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me that she was asked a question about the Cuban Missile Crisis, and she didn't know what the Cuban Missile Crisis was. I went back and watched that clip. There's no indication from her demeanor that she didn't know what the Cuban Missile Crisis was. So a lot of it's that. I mean, Seth, we have less than a minute left. But a lot of it is that sort of projection of, I got this, right? I mean, that's the main message you ought to be sending.
Yeah, you heard that Mike McCurry clip, his equanimity. He sounded almost bored, right? And if you look, I look back at a lot of old clips of press secretaries, Jay Carney, Josh Earnest, Ari Fleischer. Ari Fleischer in the middle of the Iraq War, you know, completely calm, getting hammered with questions, completely calm, never lost his cool, maintained his equanimity. Sean Spicer, at the least provocation, starts yelling, starts turning it back on the press, becomes very accusatory.
Right. It's a great article. Seek it out at slate.com. And thanks to Seth Stevenson. Thanks to everybody else who helped out today, especially Betsy Kaplan, who put this show together. Some nice people are coming to talk to you now. If you would consider supporting the station now, right at this time, I don't know, it sort of works on our behalf a little bit. If you like the show that we do, then maybe make a pledge right now. Obviously, if you hate the show, wait for something else to come on, and then pledge.